On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, "Sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough." This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Mom and Dad Are Fighting is brought to you by BowlandBranch.com, the company that makes luxury bedding affordable. Order right now, and they'll give you 20% off, plus free shipping. Get sheets, towels, blankets, duvet covers, and more at BowlandBranch.com. That's BowlandBranch.com. And use the promo code MOMANDDAD. And by Club W, leading the grape-to-glass wine revolution. Answer just 6 simple questions at ClubW.com, and their algorithm will create a palate profile just for you. Get wine directly to your door, perfectly customized to match your taste. For 50% off your first order, go to clubw.com/momanddad. And by the new middle grade novel, The Terrible Two Get Worse, the hilarious sequel to The Terrible Two, which spent more than 10 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
And welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for Saturday, February 20th, the Live from Brooklyn edition. I'm Allison Benedict, an editor at Slate, and the mom of Harry 7, Sam 5, and Wally, still 2, but really, really close to being 3.
He's basically 3.
He's 3.
I'm Dan Coyce, the dad of Lyra, who's 10, and Harper, who's 8. Hi, Allison.
Hey. On today's show, we'll talk to Slate columnist Michelle Goldberg about the ethical and legal hazards of surrogacy. Then we'll be joined by 3 terrific children's artists, singer-songwriter superstar Lori Berkner, who you all know from We Are the Dinosaurs Marching Marching at your preschool graduation, and 2 Newbery Award-winning authors, Rebecca Stead and Matt De La Pena, to talk about making art for kids. Also triumphs and fails, questions from the audience, joined by my husband and noted parenting expert John Cook, and recommendations. And for our Slate Plus segment, you'll hear us debate some parenting conundra with our audience here in Brooklyn.
And we want you, if you are a fan of Mom and Dad Are Fighting, to please, please tell your friends. This time around, I would like you to please tell a drummer in your life. Like, everyone knows a drummer, right? It's like a dad, maybe he lives on the next block, and he used to be in a band, and he has a drum set in the rec room, and you're like, oh, that's funny. He has a drum set, but then at one block party, he gets wasted, and then he goes down on the drums, and he fucking wails on them. Tell that guy about our podcast, because he will love it.
And that guy is Dan Coyce.
I wish.
Also, like us on Facebook. The plan is, if we get 1 million likes, we believe we will get a parenting book deal.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which will create a creative rift between the two of us.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I will
finally
win, and then we'll have enough money to move back to Brooklyn.
All right. Our Facebook address is facebook.com/momanddadarefighting. Please help Allison move back to Brooklyn. All right, let's move on to triumphs and fails. I will go first.
Allison. Let me guess. You have a triumph.
Great guess. My triumph is that I've seen my kids 2 of the last 14 days. No, here's my actual triumph. My actual triumph is that last night, my kids said that they wanted to play the game of life with me, and I said yes, and played the whole game of life with them because that game fucking sucks. The game is terrible. It's boring. It's repetitive. It teaches terrible lessons. It requires no skill whatsoever. Harper demands to be the banker, but she is bad at banking. And then at the end, here's the worst part about the game of life. At the end of the game of life, not only does the player who has the most money win, they give you $50,000 for every little peg child in your car, which is the exact opposite of the way the world actually works.
one of the parenting conundrums that I wanted to do was, you really want to have another child, but some man comes up to you on the street and says he'll give you $1 million. If you don't, what do you do?
You say yes, and you take $1 million, right? Absolutely. So anyways, my triumph is that I played the game of life with my children, even though I hate it, because when you love someone, you do things for them, even if you think those things are stupid.
Good job, Dan.
Thanks. How about you?
Well, first, I just want to call back to last episode's fail of mine, which was, I guess it was considering allowing Harry to play football. I heard from a lot of listeners who did not really feel that that was a good idea. So thanks for letting me know. The thing that actually pushed me over the edge and made me decide to go the flag football route is John sent me a tweet from Larry King, who says, I do not know why any parent these days would allow their child to play football. And something that really clicked. So no football. Thanks for your concern. But my fail for this week is that my children are really not excited about camp. They just like don't want to go to camp. Why do we have to go to camp? So I thought to get them excited about camp, I would show them a promotional video of a camp that we can't afford. So they loved it, and they're really excited because it's amazing. I was crying. It looks like the best experience of their lives.
Best picture 2016.
But anyway, it turns out that actually we are going to send Harry, but we're not sending Sam. And we told Sam, who really loved the video and was like constantly asking about different parts of it. So I'm sorry, Sam. I feel really bad about that. That was probably not a good idea.
Are you? I mean, will Sam get to go to this camp someday?
He's probably not. Oh. He is going to a camp.
Every day at that camp, he'll say, you know, in the video I saw for the other camp guys, they had concierges.
Yes.
All right, let's move on to our first segment.
Okay. For our first segment, this week, we are going to talk about surrogacy with Slate columnist and special guest Michelle Goldberg. Michelle, come on out.
Give it up for Michelle Goldberg.
So this week, Michelle wrote a fascinating story about a complicated and pretty horrifying custody battle in California between a surrogate mother and the man who hired her to carry and deliver his child, or as it turns out, children. So Michelle, before we get into the larger questions about surrogacy, just tell us the facts of this case.
Okay, well, the facts are a little bit complicated. Some of you might have seen there was a story about a month ago in the New York Post. There was a surrogate who was fighting a lawsuit from the intended father who was trying to force her to abort one of the triplets that she was pregnant with. And so that's the part that kind of made the news and became a minor cause celeb among some of the anti-abortion movement, but the story is actually a lot more complicated than that. Basically, this woman is 47 years old. She's been a surrogate once before. She wants to do it one more time, probably for the final time. And the surrogacy broker, Surrogacy International, matches her with a 50-year-old man, a single man who lives with his elderly parents in Georgia and intends to spend his life savings on his dream of having a son. And so she is implanted with three male embryos. Most reproductive medical associations frown on implanting more than one or two, but there's very little laws or regulation around surrogacy in this country, so doctors can kind of do what they will, and sometimes they'll implant more than one or two in the hopes that that will raise the odds of at least one sticking. In this case, they all stick. So now she's pregnant with triplets. And the father, there's a lot of reasons why you'd want to selectively reduce if you're pregnant with triplets. It's really dangerous to have triplets for both the mother and the babies. But the rationale he and his lawyer are giving her is that she needs to reduce because he can't afford triplets. He's not in a position to take care of them. He's deaf. He's a postal worker. He is, in his emails kind of suggest that he's not entirely literate. He starts emailing the clinic saying they need to see her less because he can't afford all of her visits. And so, anyway, it turns out, is anti-abortion and didn't read the contract, which, like most surrogacy contracts, allows him to call for selective reduction. So now they're fighting about a bunch of different things. They were fighting about whether he could compel her to have an abortion. She sort of waited that out, and that's off the table now because she's going to have these three babies next month. So now the question is, now they've never met, and they've never so much as spoken on the phone because he's deaf. But now, because he said that he is broke and doesn't think he can take care of these babies, the question is then, what happens to them? She wants custody of one of them at least, and she wants some sort of hearing to determine what would be in the best interest of the other two. But California surrogacy law doesn't allow for that. I mean, basically, she kind of, it's not clear under California law if she has any more rights to these babies than anyone in this room.
Right. In California surrogacy law, she's not the mother. She is sort of,
right.
She's like the vessel.
Right, exactly. And so part of what this, so her lawyer is the same lawyer who fought the Mary Beth Whitehead case, right? Which is the surrogacy case, the Baby M case. And so his argument in this case is that what makes someone a mother is not just the genetic tie. It's that it's actually the sort of physiological and emotional processes of pregnancy. Which the interesting thing is that I think most of us would believe that in cases where somebody is pregnant with a donor egg, right? Of course, we don't think of that person as being less of a mother. But so what's different here? Is it just that she signed a contract? And is that how we define parenthood, right? By contract or by something else?
Right.
So when you were reporting this, did you feel the lack of regulation that sort of made this situation possible? Did you feel it left her more vulnerable, him more vulnerable? But, like, I found myself totally confused where to sort of have my allegiances in this story.
Right. I think in certain ways they're both, there are certain ways in which they're both not entirely sympathetic, and there are certain ways in which they're both victims. I mean, I think that they were both left unprotected by the lack of regulation, right? I mean, to begin with, you know, in most countries, you can't just implant someone with three embryos, and it's not clear to me that you should even be permitted to do that. But, you know, it's also the financial arrangement between the two of them, the fact that there's kind of no money in escrow to pay her medical costs now that things have gotten complicated is also, you know, a function of the total lack of regulation. And I think she assumed, naively, perhaps, that somebody had done some sort, that before she got into this, somebody had done a background check on him and had done a home study and kind of, you know, an assessment of what kind of his fitness to be a parent.
Which would happen like in an adoption situation.
Right, and that actually doesn't exist in surrogacy. You don't have to really do anything. The surrogacy broker did do a criminal background check, but that's it. So nobody involved in this entire process has visited his house in Georgia. Or really kind of knows anything about him or his living situation, about his kind of personal life. And so then there's a question, you know, when I've brought this up with his lawyer says, well, did anybody visit your house when you were pregnant to see if you were fit to raise a child? And I guess in a certain sense, right, that's fair enough. Although I think on some intuitively it feels different to me.
Right. Like, so it's interesting that surrogacy in the United States is treated much more like a traditional pregnancy than it is treated like an adoption
scenario. Right, exactly.
Right.
And so, you know, at least some of the medical ethicists I've talked to have said, well, no, because it is more like an adoption scenario in at least certain ways. And so there should be some sort of mechanism in place to do that. But right now there isn't. So right now she's basically trying to challenge the California law and...
Which is the most... surrogacy-friendly law in the
country,
right?
There's like a reason that California is the country or the state that gave us, you know, Octomom and all of, you know, there's been like a whole bunch of surrogacy scandals in California. And the weird thing is that, right, her lawyer, Harold Cassidy, is this, you know, very conservative Catholic who's also very active in the anti-abortion movement and is not somebody I would usually find myself sympathetic to on any issue. But I do feel very sympathetic to Melissa and her case, you know, and the case that he's making on her behalf. On a couple of different levels. On the one hand, it seems pretty clear to me that even if somebody signs a contract, you can't force them to have an abortion.
Right.
Right. I mean,
that's much of an issue of reproductive rights.
Right.
As
that's
you say
reproductive
in the piece.
Rights. Yeah. That's a violation of reproductive rights. And then it seems to me, again, on an intuitive level, wrong that that we decide parentage in these cases purely by contract. There's kind of no mechanism for a court to weigh anything except for a business contract.
Right, because the mother has no rights legally. She's
right.
Not
well,
the
legally
mother.
She's not the mother. Right. Right. So basically, if in a custody case you have two people who are the parents and you are deciding between them, but before you can even get to a custody case, you have to have parents. So if she's not legally a parent, then she has no standing to challenge custody.
And the fact that she signed a contract, I mean, I want to broaden this out to a larger conversation in a second, but the fact that she signed a contract doesn't make you feel like them's the breaks?
I mean, I don't feel like that in general. I mean, you know, I've certainly never read a 75-page contract.
Thank goodness the Slate freelancer agreement is a 75-page contract. Yeah.
You know, I think that... I think she was poorly served by her first attorney.
Who was paid for by the surrogacy company, right?
Right. Well, was paid for by the father.
Oh, by the father. Okay, yeah.
So she was poorly served in that sense. But I also just kind of feel like, I don't feel in general like them's the breaks. You know, I think that if somebody signed a contract to give someone else their kidney and then changed their mind, we wouldn't be like, sorry, you know. If somebody signed a contract to give up a baby for adoption and then reconsidered, there's mechanism, they can do that, right? I mean, we kind of don't hold contracts sacrosanct in all cases.
But certainly when it's an issue of like something that seems bigger and more important to us, like family, we allow in our heads the notion that a contract shouldn't be the last line in that question.
Right, and both morally and legally. I mean, legally, not all contracts are enforceable, you know, and so that what this turns on is this contract enforceable?
Is the judge trying to make a decision mostly or solely based on what's in the best interest of the children?
Well, no, that it won't. It would have to. The judge can't. As it stands now, the judge can't consider what's in the best interest of the children, because before a judge can do that, she would have to be ruled a parent, and then the judge could kind of weigh between the two of them what's in the best interest of the children. And it hasn't gone anywhere near that far. There's two different cases right now. There's the case in family court where the father has filed a motion asking to be declared the sole parent of these three children and kind of severing her parental rights before they're born. Because usually if you go to a hospital and you have a baby, you're automatically considered the mother, right? So he needs to get sort of a preemptive ruling that in this case, that's not true. And then there's the federal case where she and her lawyer are challenging California's surrogacy law, which kind of allows for these sorts of contracts and allows for her rights to the baby she's carrying to be kind of severed preemptively.
Right. So one of the things that your piece really drove home to me that I hadn't really thought about before is not only how unregulated and how different all the laws are in the United States, but how surrogacy for money is like not legal in many, many places in the world. And people I love have had babies through surrogacy, and it seems crucial and important to me, but at the same time, I sort of get the willies when I learn that there's
something that
Americans do right. That everyone else thinks is a bad idea.
I mean, I feel the same. I feel very much the same way. It's very hard for me to condemn surrogacy outright. You know, there's kids in my building that my kids play with that were born through surrogacy arrangement, and, you know, I certainly would never want to deny their parents the opportunity to have a family. And so to me, but I also don't know if the question is really that binary. I don't have a problem with surrogacy, and I don't even really have a problem with commercial surrogacy or surrogacy for money. I just think it needs to be better regulated.
So if you were to write those laws, if someone said, Michelle, it's on you.
Here's a 75-page contract to write these laws.
I think the places I would start, first of all, is that I would have some sort of background check akin to what you have in an adoption, you know, some sort of home study, someone actually visiting the house, somebody actually determining who the next, if there is someone who's going to take care of these kids if something happens to this parent, particularly when there's only one parent. I mean, I think that that's a start. And then I think maybe there should be some sort of mechanism for a surrogate, not to kind of unilaterally claim custody, but some sort of mechanism in which a surrogate can kind of ask for a hearing on the best interests of the children.
All right, the piece is really interesting. It is on Slate. It was our Monday cover story this week. Everyone should totally check it out. We'll have a link on our Facebook page and on our show page. Thank you very much,
Thank
Michelle.
Thanks so much,
Michelle.
Really
Thanks.
Hey, this is Dan back in the studio taking a break from the live show to talk to you about our first sponsor, Bowl & Branch. There's one really important thing that can make a live show go way better, and that's getting a really good night's sleep the night before. And so you should get sheets like we do from a sheet company that takes sleep just as seriously as every parent I know does. And that's Bowl & Branch. Bowl & Branch is the company that gets you luxury bedding, sheets, towels, blankets, duvet covers at a great price without the department store hassle and without the department store markup. And Bowl & Branch has a great offer for Mom and Dad Are Fighting listeners. You can go to bowlandbranch.com today for 20% off your entire order, of sheets and towels and everything that they do. Plus, you get free shipping. It comes beautifully packaged, and they will let you try everything they make risk-free for 30 nights. After 30 nights, if you don't like it, send it back. No problem at all. You get 20% off your entire order at bowlandbranch.com. Use the promo code MOMANDDAD. That's BOLLANDBRANCH.com. Promo code MOMANDDAD. All right, back to the live show.
Okay, now is the time of the show when we normally take a listener call. So if you've got questions, call us at 424-255-7833, and we'll try to answer them. But this week, we're going to take questions from the audience. So if you have a question, line up at the mic. And joining us to answer is my husband. And parenting nemesis.
Hello.
John Cook, who is also the executive editor of noted mommy blog Gawker Media.
I think people are really rushing to line up, but first I have a question, John.
I have a question for Allison, actually. When was the Civil War fought?
Dan.
It was totally in the 19th century. John, how do you feel about this camp that you're... that one or none of your sons can afford to go to?
First of all, the reason we can afford it is because we
yes! My parents are helping us. I think we're going to get into this.
No, let's get into it.
Lay it all bare. I was adamantly against it. Uh-huh. It's too nice.
Uh-huh.
It's like a rich kid's camp.
You feel like it's not a camp unless your kids get Zika.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, just like, there should be like, you know, they should be filthy, and it should be basically like, you know, kicking cans
We have a question right here. Hello.
Hello.
Tell us your name, and also if you have kids, their ages and names if you're willing.
Tell us how great your life is.
My name is Becca, and I have a daughter, Charlotte, who is 11 months old. And thank you so much for your podcast. I love it. I listen to it regularly.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I have a question for Allison and her husband about how the city versus suburbs is going. And I just want to hear an update on that. We went to New Jersey last Friday, and our...
Wait, you moved to New Jersey?
No, we went just to scout it out.
On a scouting trip?
Just a scouting trip. Like, we looked at some open houses and things like that. So I was just curious on the how it's going and everything.
Maybe give listeners and people here who don't know the whole saga a little bit of background.
How much time do you have? The abbreviated version of the saga is that we have three children, which, as John says, like, what did you think was going to happen when we had a third kid? And we can't afford camp without your parents' help. We lived in a decent-sized apartment, but one bathroom.
Three bedroom, one bath.
Like, really, like,
five humans and a dog.
We once found Harry sitting and peeing on the toilet with Sam standing facing him, peeing through his legs. Which I was very proud of. Anyway, so I thought we could live like that forever. John did not. And he ultimately won and dragged me to New Jersey. So you just want to know how it's going. How's it going?
Yeah.
It's great. It's fantastic. I have a
Other than the loneliness.
I have a cord of firewood stacked in our backyard. We have a fireplace. Nice. I like that. It's
Wake up and John starts a fire at like 10 in the morning. I am sure there's someone in the audience that has been subjected to this. starts a fire at 10 in the morning. The house is like, I'm like choking, gagging all day. It's going.
Well, you know, you need to open the damper in your house.
Yeah, no, I know. But the advantage of the fire is I get to sit there and like watch the fire.
Yeah.
Like I could, I don't need television. Like I can't deal with you right now. I have to tend this fire. Make sure.
I feel like ultimately it was the only decision we could make. And so I'm at peace with it. But there are a lot of things that I miss about here. And there are a lot of things that I love about there. I'm not yet the person who's like, you know, I can't. I don't know how you guys do it. I don't know how you live in Brooklyn. I don't feel that way yet.
This is very emotional because we're actually back in Brooklyn,
right?
Which is, you know. But I rode the subway.
But
here.
Do it. You should do it. You should totally do it.
You should, if possible, move to Maplewood and be friends with Allison. Thank
okay,
you very much.
Thank you so much.
Hello.
Hi. I'm Roger. I'm the father of James, who is 6 months. And my question is for both halves of the loving Brooklyn and loving suburbs divide here. But of when you left Brooklyn, what is the thing that you were obsessed with that you thought you would miss the most that you don't? And then regarding the suburbs, what is the thing that you love the most that you know just wouldn't exist in an urban environment?
The thing that I love the most that I didn't expect is the walk to the train station. It's like to and from the train station to commute into the city. It's quiet and the houses are pretty and it's just like a, I don't know, it's a different kind of walk than to the subway here, and it gives me a tiny bit of peace.
It's your 5 minutes of peace,
yeah,
in your entire life?
Yeah.
Yeah. What did you think you would miss about Brooklyn, but it turns out you don't miss it at all? Nothing. Allison thought she'd miss the murderers, but she doesn't even miss the murderers.
I guess I don't miss the trash. Sometimes I still miss the trash. But like, I don't miss the trash all the time.
As someone who has been in the suburbs longer than you guys, I will say that I really thought that I would miss just like the city noise. I thought I was the kind, like I thought I had turned into the kind of guy who could not go to sleep without like honking horns and swearing hobos outside my window. But it turns out actually I can. In fact, I sleep better.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next question.
Hi, I'm Nicole. I have two daughters, Catherine, who's 11, and Vivian, who is 8. And recently, our 11-year-old has become very good friends with a boy. And from snooping on her texts, I can see that there's lots of, like, heart emojis going on. So we got a text from our babysitter a couple weeks ago that said, you know, I have to drop the other kid off at dance class. Catherine and this boy want to know, can they stay here while I go do that? And certainly, if it was a friend who was a girl, I would have no problem leaving them alone for half an hour. And they're 11. And I don't know what the rules are for having your girls be friends with boys when they're 11, and at what point that changes.
As long as there are no eggplant emojis, I think you're probably okay.
It's mainly the cats with the heart eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the most sexless of emojis. I think it's fine. I think, like, I mean, they'll definitely get into trouble, but it's not trouble that, like, you should worry about that much. It's like wholesome, funny trouble, not damaging, horrible trouble.
At right? what like, age do you worry about damaging, horrible trouble?
I mean, certainly puberty would have to occur first, right?
I don't know.
I would assume, yeah. I mean, they'll maybe steal your credit cards and order some stuff on Seamless, but other than that, I think it'll be okay.
At what age did you give her a phone?
It's 10. Your fault. That's what he's trying to say.
No, I just want to know.
I actually already asked Nicole this during the cocktail hour, and she ducked the question.
No, she got a phone when she was 10, when the number of children who had phones went over 50% at her age range. And now she walks to school by herself and things like that, so she actually does use it to like keep in touch with the babysitter and things like that, because she's in middle school.
I think you should encourage this friendship, and I think it's fine for them to be alone together. But you could also talk to her.
Yeah. She was explaining to her younger sister that boys couldn't have sleepovers with girls, and her younger sister was like, why? And she said, I don't know. I think it's like the first rule in the parenting book is like no sleepovers with boys.
God, what if there was a parenting book?
Wouldn't that be awesome?
Thank you so
Thank
much,
you.
Nicole. All right.
We're going to take
we have
one
more question.
Hi, my name is Jacqueline, and I have 2.5-year-old twins. And the question we were actually talking about on our way out here was my twins are still using their binkies to go to sleep, and they're also still in their cribs. So this summer I decided that they're going to have to go into big girl beds, and we're going to have to take care of the binkies since they're going to be 3. But what comes first? Take away the binkies, put them in their beds. If it's not broke, don't fix it.
Binkies, blankets, or?
No, pacifiers.
I'd say, I would give them a phone first. They're old enough in New York.
I would do it all at once.
Yeah, do it all at once.
Do it all at once.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be horrible no matter what, so just fucking do it.
Right? They're not going to remember it. Don't worry about it.
No, they just don't know
about everything.
Like, what's worse? Do you take the binkies?
That's what he said about moving, and
it's
do
true. They will remember it. They won't, no matter what horrible thing happens, they won't remember it
later.
What's
less traumatizing for me?
Yeah.
Well, so like, are you a rip the Band-Aid off fast person, or are you a take it off really slowly because maybe it won't hurt as much person?
I'd like to think I'm the rip it off.
Be that person and just fucking do it.
Although I think the bed would be an easier transition.
To start with the bed first.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's like 2 or 3 nights max.
Right, and that's more like an adventure that they're embarking on and less like a finger. The audience
was
like, no. Some of the audience
still
sleeps in their cribs.
Yeah, and our 5-year-old still drags around a blanket that we haven't taken away from him, so we really shouldn't be giving any advice or hosting a podcast.
Allison just negated the entire purpose of this podcast. Thank you so much for your question. Thank you, everyone, for your questions. Thank you, John Cook, executive editor of Gawker and client of my wife. Have fun at your trial, John.
Once again, here's Dan in the studio. Mom and Dad Are Fighting is also brought to you by Club W, who's leading the grape-to-glass wine revolution. With Club W, you don't have to worry about going to the wine store and figuring out which of these bottles is good and which is bad and how you even know whether it's good or bad, and especially how you know whether you're going to like it or not. At Club W, you fill out their revolutionary palate profile survey, and they will create a profile just for you that figures out what you like, what your tastes are, how sharp or fruity or lasting a wine you like. And they will send wines directly to you that they have made, that they have gotten directly from winemakers to appeal to your taste. Club W is offering Mom and Dad Are Fighting listeners 50% off their first order. That is 50% off when you go to clubw.com/momanddad. Don't ever come home to a wine-free house again. I made that mistake once. I'll never do it again. Just go to clubw.com/momanddad and get 50% off your first order. All right, back to the live show.
Okay, moving on to segment number 2. I'm very, very, very excited about our 3 next guests. They're 3 incredibly creative people making art for family audiences, and we're going to talk to them today about what it's like when your biggest fans our little, little people. Okay, moving on to segment number 2. I'm very, very, very excited about our 3 next guests. They're 3 incredibly creative people making art for family audiences, and we're going to talk to them today about what it's like when your biggest fans are little, little people. Lori Berkner is an award-winning, best-selling recording artist for children who's known for her 9 albums and her appearances on Jack's Big Music Show and Sing It, Lori. Matt De La Pena is the author of 5 young adult novels, including Ball Don't Lie, and he won a Newbery Medal this year for his picture book with Christian Robinson, Last Stop on Market Street. And Rebecca Stead is also a Newbery winner for her remarkable novel, When You Reach Me, which also happens to be Lyra's all-time favorite book. Please welcome Lori Berkner, Matt De La Pena, and Rebecca Stead. All right, so welcome. We are so glad that you guys are here. Now, I think that each of you have had a little bit of a different experience in your career as a children's artist with your own children. Now, do you all have children? Is that correct? But some of you started making children's art before you had kids, like Lori, I think, for example, and Rebecca, right? And Matt, did you? No, Rebecca, you.
No.
You did not start until after you had already had kids.
Right.
So how do you find that making, those of you who started before you had kids, how do you find that making art for kids changes when you have your own kids in the audience? And Rebecca, for you, how do you find that, do you find that it feels easy to you, or do you find that it, that you wonder if you ever could have done this before you had kids, whether you could have made that connection?
Wow, that's a good question. I actually don't think about my kids much when I'm working and writing. I mostly write from my own childhood, really, from my own memory of being a kid, and that's what I'm thinking about. In fact, if I thought about my kids a lot when I was working, it would kind of mess with my head a little bit. It just would not bring me to my creative place. That's not a diss. My parenting brain is really very different from my creative brain.
That's interesting. I mean, is that true for the rest of you too? Is, do you find those are two totally separate worlds for you?
I gotta say, like for me, I was so excited to have a daughter because I'd been asking other authors, like, what's it like, you know, when your kid reads your book? And now I had a picture book, and I was so excited to read this picture book to my daughter. So I got the FNG, which is like the galley form of the picture book. And I read it to my daughter. She was about 4 months old, and she just started sobbing. And like, and I was like, this is not what I was planning. So, so you know what I did is I said, you know what, it's late tonight. Maybe she's just like in a bad mood. And I put her to bed, and then early in the morning, her best hours, I read it again, and she started sobbing again.
Well, so Matt, maybe she was just extremely moved.
Yeah.
Well, she doesn't live with us anymore. No, I'm just kidding. But eventually she came around. It took her a year.
Lori, how did
reading
it change?
To her every day.
Oh, yeah, every day.
Yeah, yeah.
How did it change for you, Lori?
Well, I had been doing children's music for about 10 years before I had my daughter, and I was terrified of becoming a parent, actually, because I thought it would change everything about how I wrote, because I, like you, Rebecca, I think a lot about my own memories. I connect a lot to my inner child, and being a parent, of course, there's that too, but I really imagined that I would start to see the whole world from that adult perspective that I was didn't really want to be writing from, because I want the music to feel like it's owned by the kids, you know, that it's really, when they sing those songs, they feel like it's them singing, not being sung to. And basically the first year that I had my daughter, I wrote a ton of songs, and every single one of them had the name Lucy in it. It was like everything was about her. And after a while, I just had to kind of force myself to remember, that's the parent song. No, I'm not writing that one right now. I'm going to write something else. So it made a big difference.
So you guys are all New Yorkers. You live in different parts of New York, all of you. But how do you find that the city affects your ability and your interest in making art for kids? And how do you see it reflect in your own work? Matt, go first.
Sure. Well, you know, I live in New York, but I get to go into high schools and middle schools and even elementary schools all over the country. And it's very interesting to see how kids in New York are growing up differently from kids in Ohio. And it's fun for me to be, you know, to kind of like go to the gym, play basketball with these young guys and just listen to them. And so sometimes, like, I tell people, like, I don't even think I'm writing anything new. I'm just plagiarizing what I hear, you know?
Totally.
Yeah, yeah. So it's fun in New York, though, because you hear very interesting language constructions. Like, I'm very interested in the poetry of broken English. So that plays out in so many different ways because there are so many people from different communities here.
I was thinking similarly that I write a lot of songs by just taking a walk outside or getting on a bus and listening to kids talking and catching a snippet of something and going, oh my God, that's a perfect song. You know, they just talk in lyrics all the time
totally.
To me. Yeah, and so that is a really exceptional thing about living in the city is that I'm not taking my car everywhere and sort of isolated in my transportation. I can just go outside and at the end of the block, there's a tot lot and, you know, I can not hopefully look too weird walking around there by myself. But, you know, I do that a lot. I actually detour through playgrounds and places just to listen to what kids say.
Yeah. I'm curious how you guys think about your audience. Like, are you because they're kids, are you trying to teach, do you feel like you're trying to teach a lesson through your work? Are you trying to push them to feel certain emotions or to confront certain, you know, fears? Or are you just trying to entertain them, or none of those things? You're not thinking about them at all.
I think we're definitely trying to entertain them. But aside from that, I hate messagey books. So I don't write with a message. But I do, at the same time, I think as a writer, I have a goal, which is that I want my readers to kind of, what I really want is some kind of like opening. I want my readers to feel a little bit braver about connecting with other people in the world, and a little bit maybe in awe, you know, of, I don't know, life, death, and the beauty of it all, and also a little bit more willing to be vulnerable. So I have these like weird, lofty, probably unattainable goals, but nothing with like a specific message, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I would actually concur with that quite a bit. I think, you know, when I'm writing, I definitely avoid the message because that's the death of good literature. Yeah. But I think all writers do have a point of view, and this is a place you're coming from. And for me, I mean, I view myself as kind of a working class warrior, you know, so I'm always writing about working class kids and mixed kids because I'm mixed race myself. So you do kind of have a place you're coming from. Mm-hmm. So even though you're not coming at it with a message, it's like there's something that you're exploring, and it's more of a question than an answer.
Yep. Yeah, I think a lot about wanting to write about things that I care about, right? And that I kind of, both that I think about as an adult and that I also worried about or loved or had some kind of a feeling, whatever it was, about as a kid. Mm-hmm. So it's combining those two things, I think, often is what makes it interesting for me to sing the songs and write the songs, and then relevant for a kid to listen to the songs. And then hopefully that also means, since what I'm writing is music and I want everybody in the family to be listening to it, then hopefully it's also relevant for the adults that are listening. But saying, again, giving a message is that ends up being something that makes me feel like I'm being didactic, like I'm teaching, and I want the music to be different from going to school. It's like, it's fun and it's enjoyable, but I do hope that people will feel or be affected in some way, even if it's just that they thought it was funny or, you know, enjoyed it.
But it's interesting though, because there is a message still encoded in this work, and I think you guys are all artists who are very good at not making it didactic and not making that feel to adult readers or to kid readers like that's the point of it. But, you know, it's like when I read your most recent novel, Rebecca, there's clearly a real message there that kids can pull out about respecting their own bodies and respecting technology. Mm-hmm. And Matt, there's clearly a message in your book, which won the Newbery this year, about doing good for the world and embracing the life that you have and embracing the opportunities that you have. And so it's interesting to me to think of those as driven not by the goal of telling not by the goal of putting those messages forth when you write, but those are the things that you believe in, and so they sort of naturally grow in the things that you are writing and working on.
Could I throw this out there? I think the cool thing about writing in any medium is that you leave space for the reader. And so the reader is the one who pulls those messages, you know, and you're not planting them there. You're just telling a story with this point of view, but the reader can come in and make the work bigger than it really is, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and it's interesting that for all of you, the reader or the listener or whoever, it's a very small person who doesn't have that much experience necessarily meeting a work halfway. Mm-hmm. And so I always wonder how much you think about that, how much you think about that small person who maybe has never thought about this issue at all, who never has thought about texting in the capacity that you're talking about, or has never thought about the things that you're singing about, and you're both introducing these new ideas and asking them to meet you halfway. Do you think about how hard it might be for them to reach you? Do you think about how you also pitch the message to a parent to help them help them come to grips with those things?
I think that's, I actually think very much the way, we didn't plan this, but very much the way Matt does. And I talk about readers' work all the time. And you do have to think about what you're putting out there and what the reader has to work with. But I think that it boils down to respect, really, for your reader. So if I'm writing about three seventh graders who are exploring sexuality, using their phones in new creative ways, and talking to one another, and loving one another, and challenging one another, I don't have a point of view about which of these kids is making exactly the right decisions and which of them is making mistakes, because I trust my readers to have their own thoughts, come to their own conclusions. And I think that, you know, any good book for children does that. I mean, not with, you know, in its own way.
Laura, I wanted to ask, Laura, you have said that you had trouble writing music until you decided to write music for children. Can you articulate, or do you even know why that sort of helped you?
Oh, I didn't have trouble writing music. I had trouble writing good music.
Okay.
I mean, sort of. I mean, I just felt like I wrote these songs that just went on and on and on and on, and very kind of... I don't know, you just didn't want to listen to all of them. But I, you know, big rock band and long, long things. So I, when I started writing music for kids, I started realizing, oh, if I have something to say, I have to say it quickly, interestingly, and a lot of times in the same song and then be done. And that was like, oh, that I could do that. Like, that actually was kind of fun because it really forced me to edit what I was writing and to be very focused about what I was trying to say. And in just on that last question, it was making me think a lot. I have a song called I'm Not Perfect, and it was something that I totally wrote for myself because I lost my date book before anyone even had PDAs. Does anyone even know what that is?
Oh, sure, my Palm Pilot.
Yes, yeah. Before I had my Palm Pilot, before my iPhone. And my date book had, I was like doing birthday parties for kids, and it had everybody's... wow. All the information in there, and I thought only in there, and I lost it on a bus, and I did not get it back. And I had this, you know, every night I go to bed going, like, whose party am I forgetting tomorrow? What child is going to like be traumatized for life I didn't show up and ruin their birthday party? And so I just started singing this song to myself. I'm not perfect. I'm not perfect. You know, I was in therapy at the time. It was very it was very appropriate. And but it came out as this very short little ditty that, like, I just used the word ditty. That felt so, it felt so soothing to say to myself. And I would then get letters from parents like, oh, my two-year-old is singing that now, you know. And, of course, they're confused because everyone tells them, you're perfect, just the way you are. But then there's a discussion, right? And I remember thinking, well, will any kid really get this? And... they do, you know, just what you were talking about, Rebecca, that like respect for your audience. But also letters from adults who were like, I was out of work and I just sat around and listened to that song and it made me feel better, you know. So it is, it's kind of neat to think about where is it going to hit and find out where those things are going to happen.
Mm-hmm. All right, so I'm really curious about what it is like to have a bunch of kids who love your work and really look up to you. I only have two kids in my house who think I'm terrible and don't respect me at all. So I'm just curious, like, you know, what are those experiences like? And also, kids can be very upfront critics of your work. And, I mean, have you had that experience of a kid just straight up telling you, yeah, no, your book is not for me? Your song is boring.
We want to know, like, the horror stories from your shows and readings.
Okay, I'll tell you one that's amazing to me to this day. It happened 5 years ago. This kid sent me an email, and he said, my first book is called Ball Don't Lie, and the title was Ball Don't Lie, Best Book Ever. And then I was like, I'm going to sit down with a beer and read this one. So I was very excited. And then I read it, and it was talking about some kid named Bob that lived in North Carolina, which was completely not my book. So he just got the title mixed up. And I was like, oh, thanks, bro. But so does anybody ever quote Charles Barkley on your show?
On this show? No. Okay. Charles Barkley has never once been quoted on
this.
So
this is the first show? Okay, so he has this idea where he said, if everyone likes you, you're lying to somebody. And I feel like that translates to art. You have? Okay. So that's old news. But I just think that you just know that, hey, look, not everybody's going to like what you do. And the quicker you can get over yourself, the better.
I mean, that's a lesson that authors for adults have trouble learning, for sure. But maybe they just don't have enough people email them and tell them that they just didn't like their stuff.
Maybe.
What about the other two of you? Do you have...
I once got a letter. I opened it up and it just said, do you have J.K. Rowling's telephone number?
Amazing.
But do you?
I don't. Sorry.
I remember the first show I ever did was I was by myself in a auditorium, and I went out there and I started playing, and I realized when I would do songs that the kids didn't like, they just walked away. And, and I thought, this is why I love kids music. You know immediately what is going on. It's much better than playing to drunk people at 1 in the morning on Long Island. And, but it was really great because I learned so much. I was like, oh, that's not what I'm going to do in this show again, you know? I find them to be pretty straight up harsh critics.
All right.
So what music or books, what do you guys love for your kids? And I'm especially curious, Lori, do you, when your daughter was growing up, did you play kids music for her or did you...
You only played your own songs?
This is mommy, this is daddy. I tried things like Louis Prima and Hawaiian slack key guitar, and there was only so far that would go. And then, I started playing other music. Actually, one that I remember a lot was that we played Brady Reimer's stuff, and now he plays with me, which is the most incredible thing. Cool.
Matt, what does your daughter like to read that does not make her cry?
Well, almost everything else she seems to be fine with. No, you know what? I got to tell you, it's my first picture book. I did it before I had a daughter, and she's 21 months old now, and watching her mind just light up when you read picture books to her, it's like now I understand the power of the picture book. It's just an incredible experience, and watching her want the book 3 times in a row and look at different things each time and feel the emotion of the arc. Sometimes she gets upset when a monkey loses his, I don't know, the stuff in his suitcase. Well, yeah. But so, I love it. And I try to, she's a mixed race kid. And so I love doing diverse books with her, especially. I think it's really important for her, especially living in Brooklyn.
So my boys are teenagers. I've lost all control or connection to the material they're looking at. Maybe I should stop right there. My older son, for about a year, he was a huge reader. He just read anything, really, that we had in the house, he would read. So he would read books with girls on the cover and, glitter and things that people say boys won't read. He totally read it. He read tons of science fiction. He loves graphic novels. Read all kinds of stuff. And then for about 18 months, he would only read fan fiction. And I thought, this is really fascinating. Mm. He's appreciating other people's writing, and he's learning about the craft of writing. You guys know about fan fiction, right?
Oh, I know about it hardcore.
So then 3 years later, he said, Mom, a lot of that was kind of erotic.
That's amazing.
So all those times I was approvingly thinking, oh, he's really in the forefront. a reader's experience in today's world. But I will say that both my kids grew up in part, up to a point, on Lori's music. So it's very fun to be here with her.
All right. Thank you so much, all three of you. Everyone should check out everyone's work here. Lori Berkner's music, Matt De La Pena, and Rebecca Stead's books. They are all really, really great. We are so happy and proud to have all three of you here. Everyone give them a hand, please.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, one more time, Dan in the studio at our live show, which we recorded last night, we had a bunch of copies of The Terrible Two Get Worse from our great third sponsor, Abrams Books. It's a great sequel to The Terrible Two, which you may remember if you're a longtime listener to the show, was a favorite book of Lyra's and a favorite book of mine. It also was a favorite book of many people. It spent over 10 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. It's published by Amulet, and the series has turned the world upside down for lovers of pranks and pranksters. It's perfect for fans of Diary of a Wimpy Kid. It's perfect for reluctant readers. The authors, longtime friends and certified pranksters, Mac Barnett and Jory John, are bent on prankster domination. In the sequel, this new installment, The Terrible Two Get Worse. Check it out. It's from Abrams Books, and you can get it wherever books are sold. Back to the show.
Let's move on to recommendations, Dan.
Okay. I'm going to recommend a recipe, which is great for, this is actually a very high-pressure recommendation. I did not think it would be because our food editor is sitting right there. L.V. Anderson. But so this is a really great recipe, which is perfect for the days when you have been inside your house because of snow for 12 straight days, and your kids haven't gone to school and you don't have any food left, but you need to make dinner anyway. It is spaghetti with fried eggs and olive oil. It's so easy. You just heat up some olive oil, and you throw some garlic and maybe some shallots in it, if you even have shallots, and then you boil some spaghetti, and then you drop a couple of eggs, you crack some eggs in the oil, and then when the whites are set, you just mix all that shit up together, and then you put so much Parmesan cheese in it. It's not only easy and delicious, and it has everything that you already have in your house, but it is the first thing that I have made in 11 months that both my children willingly ate. So it was a huge, enormous success. That's it. It's so easy. That's all there is to it. Allison, what about you?
Yeah, a lot of people wrote in the last time. I don't remember what we were talking about, but I said I had never cooked chicken before, and people sent me all these like easy chicken recipes.
Yeah. And you laughed at them all.
I haven't tried any of them.
It's not easy enough for me.
That was starting to sound easy, and then the egg whites.
You just crack an egg in a pan.
Okay, my recommendation is, so for my parents are both turning 70 this year, and for their 70th birthday, they said all they wanted was for me and my sister to come visit them in Florida without our spouses and without our children. So basically, they wanted to pretend like we had never grown up. And my sister and I thought this was a very strange request, which we haven't told them that we thought it was strange, but now they're going to hear it.
Yeah.
But we decided we should do it because this is really all they wanted, and we also couldn't think of anything better to get them. We got them like a platter. But so we did this, and it was really fun. I highly recommend it. I wouldn't do it like all the time, but original family vacations. My parents treated us, I mean, you have to buy into it. So let them pay for everything. Let them do your laundry.
When Allison told me this story, I laughed because my mom asked the exact same thing out of me and my brother. She was like, I love Ollie and Stacy, but I just would love to spend some time with my boys. So we're going with her to the Grand Canyon in April to let her buy everything.
The thing that's actually really nice about it, genuinely really nice about it, this is a really great trip. I mean, of course, it's really nice to like not have any responsibility when you normally have three kids and a husband who you're responsible. I'm not really responsible for you, but it's also nice because it's this very familiar dynamic, right? It's like the family you grew up with, but now you're all adults. And I don't know, there was something special about
Really liked the times when I've been able to like be with my brother as brothers, except for now we're adults, so we're not assholes all the time.
Right, yeah. Right.
That's big. That's a great recommendation. Everyone should totally do that if you have the chance. That's our show. Please like us on Facebook so that we hit 1 million likes and Allison and I can get in a fight and she can move back to Brooklyn. It's facebook.com/momanddadarefighting, and send us an email at momanddad@slate.com to give us ideas for topics or guests or to send Allison chicken recipes that she will not cook. Mom and Dad Are Fighting is part of the Panoply Network. See our entire roster of shows at itunes.com/panoply. Thank you to all of our guests, Michelle Goldberg, Rebecca Stead, Matt De La Pena, Lori Berkner, and even John Cook. Thanks to Faith Smith, Ann Hepperman, Daniel Powell, The Bell House, Abrams Books, Steve Lichtai, and Andy Bowers. And thank you to our amazing audience here in Brooklyn.
Thank you, Brooklyn.
Give yourselves a hand.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Allison. Good night.